This is Cave Scott Allen of OJCode.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
Hello and welcome to Herding Code. This episode is being recorded on February 5th, 2013. We are talking again to Oren Ini, a.k.a. Allende, and we talked to you a couple of years ago about RavenDB when it first came out.
Mm-hmm.
So can you give us a quick kind of recap for people that are too lazy to listen to the older show, and then and then we'll dig into the new stuff?
No, go ahead and listen.
Okay.
So RavenDB is a document database, and if you've been absolutely blind, deaf, and probably also dumb, you might have missed the notion of NoSQL and the movement away from relational databases. The whole reason for that is that relational databases are wonderful if you're building the same application that you were building in the early 90s. And we're building much more complex, much more interactive, rich, and basically just totally different application than what we were building 10 years ago. The sad thing about the relational database is that for the most part, if you really, really try, you can still sort of get it work. But sort of get it work doesn't mean that it isn't incredibly painful. And people have found over time that for a lot of their application, relational database just means that they have to fight and fight and fight the database just to get things done. About 5 years ago, I started working on RavenDB on a database that would basically get out of my way and let me just write the sort of application that I wanted to write. It's a document database, which means that the basic unit of storage is a document. A document is not in the sense of, you know, Word or Excel or something like that. It's a document in the sense that this is a JSON document. So the nice thing about JSON is that you can store arbitrarily complex data very easily. So the trivial example is the order and the order lines. In a relational database, you have to have, you know, two tables just to store that, and anything that you want to do requires a join and or multiple queries and stuff like that. With RavenDB, we're actually able to store all of that as a single entity. That means that all of the changes to the entity happen in a single location. It means that concurrency control is simpler. It means that loading or modifying that is much easier. There are a whole bunch of other stuff. RavenDB is schemaless. That means that you start writing code and you tell RavenDB, please persist this class, and it does it, and that's it. You don't have to worry about, okay, let's define the best model, and let's talk to the DBA and all sorts of stuff like that before you can even, you know, before you can write the first line of code. We try very hard to follow the mantra of it just works. So you hook up RavenDB, by default, you just double-click the executable and it starts running in debug mode. And you call install package RavenDB.client and you're done. You have a working server, you have a working client, and you initialize a new document store and you can start working. And we also spent a lot of time, so far I talked about the server, we also spent a lot of time on the client side on making sure that things are as easy and approachable as you can imagine. We have done a lot of work on the client API, so if you ever use something like an Hibernate or an entity framework, it feels very natural. You're working with object, you have the usual unit of work, transactional support, all of the good stuff you're familiar with, but without a lot of the pain that is associated with that. And I think I'm going to stop now because I literally can talk about RavenDB for days. And I think we have a more narrow focus today.
Okay. Yeah, you know, one small thing to call out that you mentioned a little bit there, and I thought was really interesting from the .NET Rocks show you did in Virginia, I believe.
Uh-huh.
One thing that you mentioned there was that you can actually be more correct, and by let's say, for instance, you know, you have a customer and an order and an address and all that, and It's very tempting in a relation model to go in and update the address. when someone moves, but that's actually destroying history of where the address was previously.
Yeah. So, yeah, if I remember correctly, think about it. If I want to store a customer address, so if he has multiple addresses, I have absolutely no other choice but to actually model that as a separate table. And if I need to store, the address that I'm sending the order to, I'm probably just going to do a reference to the address table. And that's all fine and good, but then, you know, I need to change my address. So if I go to Amazon, I can create a new address, or I can actually modify an existing address. But if you're using a relational database, you actually have to think about this upfront. And if you go ahead and ask, you know, any standard developer, they just say, oh, no, we have to have a separate table, and we have to have the reference, because this is what everyone has been taught. And now you're going to update this table and just put yourself in a very bad position because you have killed the historical record. And we actually had problems with that, legal problems. In one of my clients, they updated a value at the name of the bank account. The bank account that the employee was using to get the salary. And sometime later, the employee wanted to get a mortgage, so she went to the bank and the bank said, oh, you need the paycheck stubs. So she asked the company, can you reprint them? I didn't keep them or something like that. And since then, she changed her bank and they reprinted their payment stubs. And they said that they went to the wrong account. And the banks checked for that because it was the same bank as she was trying to get the mortgage from. And this is fraud. You're actually giving us wrong statement. And we know because there is no matching transaction to what the payment stub says. So this is fraud. And I don't know if they called the police, but it was a very, very big thing there.
Wow. Yeah, it's funny, you know, and that makes me think of all the crazy hoops that we do jump through and don't even think about it, like soft deletes and, you know, marking, okay, which is the current record and, you know, all that kind of stuff, where it's really what we're trying to do is store historical data and store documents. And we're kind of shoehorning that into this relational model of, you know. Yeah.
Yeah. And the funny thing is that, you know, people think a lot about, oh, we want to do, people are used to thinking in rows, but in practice, you almost always deal with documents. And in many, many cases, those documents tend to be complex and rich, and there are very strong semantics about when they can be changed. Think about, again, the order example is a great one. Can I change the order at the same time that I'm adding a new order line? And the answer is that most times you cannot. So I can change the address the same time that I'm adding a new order line. Maybe you cannot ship to that address. But if you're using a relational database, those are two rows on two different tables, and getting concurrency control over that would be extremely hard. In RevNB, it's a single document. You don't even think about it. You just say, use optimistic concurrency, and that's it.
So one of the big arguments that I usually hear mostly DBAs make is kind of an outdated one. They say that you want to – basically, they apply the don't repeat yourself philosophy and when they're applying normalization. So, you know, so if you've got this document stored five different times, just different versions of it, they say, well, you're storing that address five different times, and that wastes space. But it's kind of outdated now because disk space is, you know, much cheaper than it used to be. So other than that, what are some other arguments against the whole, you know, you're repeating the data?
Space is the major one. There is also additional computation resource required because if you're adding documents all the time, then the database is going to be large. Then you have to do more indexing, more those sort of things. The problem with that, the moment that you start talking about, oh, I want to normalize things, then you start thinking, wait a second, it doesn't actually make sense for a lot of reasons. I don't actually want to normalize things because, again, the address on the order, the bank account on the payment stub, a lot of the things you want them to be frozen. And if any of you ever try to work with temporal systems in a relational database, it's excruciatingly bad the amount of work that you have to do there. There have been books written about the patterns related to temporal databases just because this is so hard to do. If you accept from the get-go that you don't need to normalize things all over the place, you realize that, hey, I just keep a copy of the data as it was, and that's done. In RavenDB, setting up a temporal database is literally setting up a checkbox. And you tell me how many revisions back you want, and that's it. And writing support for that took us, you know, maybe a day, maybe 2 days, include debug time, support questions, stuff like that. It's just a lot of the rules that you're used to came from a time when a hard disk was 2 megabytes in size, and it cost more than your house, more than everyone's house combined. But those rules no longer apply. My first computer didn't have a hard disk. It had a 5.5-inch floppy that has, I think, 360 kilobytes in size on it and was corrupted all the time. And that was the environment in which you started working with relational databases, where space is at premium and, oh, yes, so I'm reminded here about the cassette tapes and beep, 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 and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I don't even want to talk about the amount of work that you have to do to actually get reasonable performance when you're trying to do 6 on a cassette tape. And I don't even recall what the storage amount was. But think about it. That's the time when the best practices were set in stone. That's the time when people start design things. And if you go and read the curriculum in any university, if you look at why do we want to do the normalization, they will usually say, oh, you want to save space. I don't want to save space. Space is cheap. You know, even if so I hear that, no, space isn't cheap when you go to the enterprise. Well, define cheap. Yeah, on the enterprise, you know, go to Amazon. A gigabyte on Amazon with 9999 something guarantee, backup, all of those good things that you're supposed to have, a gigabyte there for a year would cost you less than a can of Coke. So maybe you have a very inefficient IT teams. Or maybe, you know, someone has their hand in the till and, ooh, a hard disk still costs $1,000 per gigabyte and stuff like that. But that's
usually what they're talking about in enterprises. They're not tiering their data correctly. So they have to have the highest, the fastest, the greatest amount of speed possible for all of their data. And that's why they say, oh, well, it's expensive in the enterprise because they got to have, you know, 10,000 RPM or SSDs across everything instead of tiering out the data and saying, hey, you know, the stuff that isn't accessed that often can go on the slower disk. It's cheaper. And the stuff that gets accessed more goes on the SSD, right? But yeah, they don't ever think of it in that term.
Actually, what they find in the enterprise, they have one database. That's it. And it's usually, yeah, if you need the database that has, you know, 256 gigabytes of RAM just to boot, that's going to be expensive no matter what. But in most cases, yeah, there is no thinking about the actual value of the data. Should this value be on super duplicated server with, so another cost that you see in that part is, oh, we have to have a backup. So you have people that take full backup every 15 minutes. That adds up. I actually have a customer that talked to me about it. We take full backups every 15 minutes, and I was shocked because their database is in the tens of gigabytes, and they've been doing that every 15 minutes for 2 years. Do the math. And, oh, no, we don't worry about that. That's someone else's problem. But, you know, I don't even know how to respond to stuff like that. If you shoot yourself in the foot, it will hurt. But
I mean, and there again, you're essentially storing documents. You're just storing a 10 gigabyte document every 15 minutes.
Yeah, pretty much.
Well, and that's one of the other things.
We don't have incremental backup. That kills me. We have that. Use it. Mm-hmm. No, we want full backups. Okay.
I think that one of the other common misconceptions, and I think we covered this on the first RavenDB show, is that they seem to view a document database as just a giant blob of text when it's a document. When you say document, that's what people think of. But it's much more structured than that, and much more searchable and indexable, and all the things that you would want out of data.
Yeah. So that's a common problem, because people used to think that, oh, this is the same as having a binary column, a table in a SQL or Oracle that has an ID and a binary column. And that means that you can do searches, you can do queries, you can do aggregation. And that's really, really not true. And in RavenDB, for example, you can do searches over everything. You have full text search for free. You can do searches. So here's another problem. In relational database, most of the time, you're always working on the very latest stuff. So ACID is very, very important there. ACID is also very important for RavenDB, but we don't have the notion of, you know, reader waiting for writers and writers waiting for readers, and everything must happen at the exact same point, and now we have to take clocks and all of those sort of things. So we do a lot of pre-computation in the background, and that means that when you actually ask us a question, we can give you the pre-computed answer very, very quickly. And trivial example, if you want to know what is the count of orders per customer, that seems to be a reasonable thing to want to do on your system, right? And you want to show it on the main page of the customer. So this is an aggregation query. This is going to show up on all of your pages. And now you start thinking about, okay, how am I going to implement that? And in SQL, you would do something like select count star from orders, or maybe you would do a group by something. I don't know. But something like that on a big table is very expensive. And I find it ridiculous that this is very expensive. In RavenDB, you tell me, okay, this is what I want. This is the results that I want to do. And you do that by writing a link, an index using link. And we pre-compute the result. And when you ask the question, we give you the result, or the pre-computed result already. There is no computation. And it doesn't matter if you have, you know, 100 million orders. We can still give you that result in 1 or 2 milliseconds.
Okay. So, and you warned us earlier that we can get you talking about document databases for, So let's dig into the new stuff. You've had some new releases lately, right?
Yeah. So last month we had the 2.0 release, and hopefully this week we're going to have the 2.01 release, which is basically, people run into 2.0 because we had almost 6 months with only unstable releases. And we had, I don't even know how many good things we have there. We improved performance on several key code paths by 1,000%. And it's really ridiculous, because what we have done is, you know, every time we made a small improvement, or let's shave a few percent, few percentage for performance here and few percentage for performance here, but over 6 months, it apparently really adds up. And indexing performance was greatly improved. We have support for executing JavaScript scripts on the server, so you can do things like mass migrations, patching of documents, those sort of things. What else did we add? Cool. We added bulk insert. We had spent tremendous amount of time on the management UI. So now it gives you a lot more information. It's much nicer to use. But probably the most important thing that we have done in the 2.0 release is that we've streamlined a lot of the things. So from the operational side of things, you have a lot more information, a lot more endpoints that you can query to see what's going on. We integrate with your standard monitoring tools much better than your performance counters, and those sort of things that will give you more insight. For the development side, we have significantly improved sharding support. We have full support for async. So if you're using C# 5, you can just start using that, and it works out of the box. You don't have to do anything. Wow, I'm drowning in the amount of things that we've done.
There's a lot there.
Yeah.
And then you mentioned after that there's a follow-on release, 2.0.1.
Yeah, and 2.01. And this is basically, you know, oh, when we run in, so here is a bug that we just ran into a few days ago. When you set up the permissions on a user, apparently we set things up so the order of permission actually matter. And that's, you know, it's not a bug in the sense that just switch the permission, it will work, but it's not an expected thing that you wanted to happen. So we have a lot of stuff like that, that finding the rough spots, I think that would be the best way of putting it. Because I think that we got a lot of things done really, really right for the 2.0, but the people who were using the unstable builds were the people who like to be on the edge. And they're perfectly happy with having some rough spots now here and there. Once we made the stable release, then, oh, this is somewhat uncomfortable and those sort of things. So that's the main point of the 2.01 release. But I have to make a confession. I really couldn't hold it. And we added a new feature. So we now have improved support for replicating to a relational database. So you have RavenDB documents inside the database, and now you want, maybe you want to integrate with your existing database, maybe you want to just run some reports and so on. So what we have done is giving you the ability to specify a script and a connection string, and then we just, you know, go and on the fly, whenever there is a change on Raven, we'll go and update the relational database that you specified and set the changes over there as well. And you can also do transformation. So again, with the order example, so the order example contains data that would go into multiple tables in the relational system. So because you have a script there, you can replicate that information to multiple tables at the same time.
Okay. So, and that again sounds like one of those, you know, for people that if you want to, if you're worried about not having relational, you know, access here, you've got the best of both then.
Yeah.
Well, so one thing you mentioned quite a bit there. One thing that you mentioned in there was improved sharding support.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to dig into that a little bit. We had a recent show where we mentioned sharding, and I know that you said that there's some new sharding improvements here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let me see if I can try to explain. So sharding support with RavenDB, we had it, I think, from the very first release. That was one of the things that I really wanted to have. Unfortunately, it was somewhat complicated and required you to do to specify a lot of things. What is your sharding strategy? What is the shard access strategy? What is the shard resolution strategy? And if you actually, I mean, just hear what I'm saying. A lot of strategy, a lot of options, a lot of flexibility, and too much complexity to actually be of use. Because before you had time to start, you actually had to now start making a lot of very, very important decisions and probably without having information on how to do them. So at some point in the 2.0 cycle, we actually decided to revamp all of the sharding support. And basically, we started from the assumption is that we're going to make it to the point where you give me the endpoints of all of the nodes that you have, and that's it. From there on, I will take care of everything else. So in order to do that, we have implemented a lot of defaults. So let's talk for example about let's say that I have companies and invoices, and I have three nodes in the cluster. So I'm going to set up a sharded document store, and that sharded document store is going to get a strategy that has a list of all of the nodes in the cluster. So far, so good. That's just the basic regression that we need, just what are the URLs that I'm going to be hitting. Now, you're going to start saving users, and you're going to start saving clients, and you're going to start saving invoices. And by default, that's going to be the data is going to be split among all of the items among all of the nodes in the cluster. So this is where things start to get interesting. By default, everything that that happened in the same transaction will always go to the same node. And this is because we are trying very hard to maintain locality. think about it. If I have three nodes and I have no locality, then the invoices for a customer may sit on a different server than the customer information, or another invoice for the same customer. That means that if I want to answer as simple as question is, as how many unpaid invoices I have for this customer, that means that I have to run a distributed query with all of the implication that this has for performance, for scalability, for, you know, just the amount of load that you're going to have on the system is number of items that you have on the shard. And so the way that we do that, we're starting with the assumption is that if they were saving the same transaction, they're going to go, and they're new objects, obviously, they're going to go into the same shard. So we even at that level, trying to maintain locality. The next step is when we ask you to give us some additional information. So you're going to say, I don't care, I have three nodes. I don't care which node gets which clients, but I do care that invoices are going to be on the same node as their clients. And that gives us the ability to optimize queries on a specific client, because I will get them. So what we need to do is just say, okay, shard the invoices based on the client ID. And this is literally just one method call, shard on, and you give it the invoice type, and then there is a lambda that you tell it what property we are going to shard on. And that's it. From then on, RavenDB is going to say, okay, this is a new invoice. This invoice belongs to customer number 3. Customer number 3 belongs on server number 2. So this invoice is going to sit on server number 2. And this gives us great locality. We don't have to worry about distributed queries unless we are actually dealing with something that crosses multiple clients. And the basic thing here is that this gives us a lot of freedom with regards to optimizations. Now, what I just described, this is the default approach. And some people have problems with the default approach because one of the things that we do, we encode the ID of the shard in the document ID. So you aren't actually going to have customer number 3. So IDs in RavenDB are usually customer /3, customer /4, and so on. The ID on a sharded cluster would be something like, let's say, 1/customer/3. Or 2/customer/4, something like that. So by encoding the shard ID into the document ID, we allow ourselves to actually do the optimizations. Without that, think about it. If you just have customer/3 and you now have to say, okay, give me this document, how would you know which shard to hit? Without knowing which shard to hit, you basically have to fall back into, let's query all the shards. Mm-hmm. And that is what you want to avoid. So
then how does that work? I mean, the obvious question there is, since the ID is keyed to the shard, which makes sense as you've explained, how does that work over time as you add on more shards or for whatever reason, you know, customers need to move or you need to rebalance things or whatever?
The typical way that you see growth is you start... So typical way to see growth is saying, okay, I'm going to add a new shard into the cluster, and then I'm going to bias the sharding function to create all of the index, all of the new objects that haven't already been assigned to a shard in the new server. So the basic idea is that okay, for the next, you know, 5 weeks or however, whatever the rate is that you have, we are going to send all of the new writes into the new server. And just that means that you don't have to change the topology, nothing has to change, but you still get a rebalancing on the fly. That doesn't help you when you actually have, okay, I have this customer, and he's so big, and he's making so many requests that I actually want to move just this customer into a separate server. And this is where things get interesting. One of the things that I've seen people do is they take the customer data and delete it from the current server and write it to the new server with different IDs. And that's something that I really, really don't recommend. That's the easy and obvious thing, but it's also wrong because now you're changing IDs, and that is a much more expensive operation to do. Instead, the key point here is that everything that you just described is just default behavior. What we can do, and it's actually quite easy to do, is to say, look, the document ID is 3/customer/4. By default, we said that this should go into the tailed node. But again, I can customize that, and this is, you know, this is already something that the customer can do. It says, okay, /3/customer/3 actually belong on the default node, and so on. Instead of having to migrate all of your data, instead of, you know, having to change all of the IDs, and this is a very expensive operation, the only thing that you need to do is just update the sharding function to say, okay, this thing goes into that server and that's it. Because the default is really good for, you know, standard stuff. Once you start needing to customize, we have the hooks in place to actually give you the ability to do so. We also had customers that says, okay, I actually don't want the shard ID in the document ID. I want to have virtual shards. And then, you know, they just define the sharding function, and there is one place in the shard, in the code that you have to override that says, okay, given this document ID, what are the applicable shard IDs that I'm going to find it on? And you override this method and says, okay, I'm going to use my virtual shards implementation, and it just works.
Okay. So, and I'm not sure if this relates directly to migration, but it does seem like you have things over time where things are changing, right? So historically, something might have gone in one place, and later something goes somewhere else. How do you handle this, you know, migration and how things change over time? And I guess that applies even to just how your documents change over time, right? Maybe that's two completely separate questions there.
I think so. So let me try to answer first the question of changes in the shards. So there isn't anything that says that your sharding function has to absolutely know what are the nodes for a server, for a document. You can say, I think it's on this node or that node or that node. And that means that this gives you the ability to do migrations by saying, okay, we're now going to migrate all of the North America customers, and while we're migrating them, they're going to be on the old server or on the new server, and this basically just handled that. You can move data between the servers by just setting up the replication, and it just works from there. And it's really easy that simple. There are no additional steps that I can think of. For when you're working with data modifications, so trivial example would be that you started out with having user.name, and now you want to actually have user.firstname and user.lastname. And this is basically you wanting to split the data into the separate fields. And it's very easy for you to actually make the change in your code. You just delete the name property and add first name and last name. But you already had, you know, 300,000 users in the system. And how do you update them? And this is where what I mentioned earlier, where you have the ability to run scripts. So you just write a JavaScript function, and you can run it over all of your users. There's actually a tab in the Management Studio that allows you to do just that. And this is effectively doing an update operation over your database, but you aren't limited to just silly statements. You actually have full JavaScript interpreter in place. You can do anything that you could do in JavaScript, which is basically everything.
I have a quick question about the migrations. How fast do they run? Like, are you running, you know, these JavaScript over all these documents? Like, how much time does that generally take for a large document set?
I don't know how to answer that because it mostly depends on I/O more than anything else. I can tell you, let's see, I have 1,000 documents in a database, and I'm going to say that this.name. So 1,000 database takes. So here's a key point. There are two things that you have to be worried about at that point. There is the initial skip parsing cost, and the second thing is the execution cost. So the initial parsing cost, it doesn't really matter that much. Let's see if I can find the thing. And I think it took something like 17 milliseconds. No, sorry. Here we go. So I think 800 milliseconds to run it the second time. And this is over 1,000 documents. The problem here is that this is not linear time, mostly because of I/O costs associated with the operation. But typically, I think that we saw something like 5 minutes over 100,000 documents on a fairly complicated script, something like that.
Okay,
we had a bunch of questions from Twitter, and Scott Kuhn had a question from friend at work or something. Do we have anything else on this stuff? Or everyone ready to move to the questions bit? That was a question itself.
I've actually got kind of two questions, one of which will be pretty easy to answer, and the other one will probably be a little more complicated. Maybe not, though. So the first one is, so you've got a lightweight client for Raven that runs on Mono. Is there any plans to migrate or to move the server so that it can run on Mono as well?
Sort of. So the answer is that we're going to write, we're probably at some point going to do a port of the server to Mono. We are currently missing some infrastructure components that we're going to replace. Probably we're going to use a Berkeley DB on Mono or something like that. But that's something that isn't very high on our priorities. You can, as you said, the client works perfectly on Mono. And that's where we're at right now in that respect.
And the second one is probably more complicated, or it could be a very simple no. Are there any plans to port either the client or server to a more compact form, thinking of running on either Windows Phone, iPhone, or even going down smaller to an Arduino or Netduino kind of board, either client or server?
So the client works on Silverlight, WinRT, and I'm pretty sure it would work on Windows Phone. Honestly, I'm furious that there are so many different and slightly incompatible in maddening ways versions of the framework.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we should run on all of those. I don't know about the Nuduino. I don't know that one. So probably we aren't going to run on that. But the client should be able to run anywhere. The client is basically just making REST calls. We have clients in obviously .NET, JavaScript, Node.js. I think there is a PHP client as well, but that's not something that I've seen recently. So anything that can make a REST call can have a client. That's the only requirement that we have.
And what about maybe coming up with a compact Raven DB so that you could let's come up with an actual kind of scenario here rather than just me asking a dumb question. Let's say you've got a disconnected app for the Surface or for iOS, iPad, and you want it to be able to run a local instance of RavenDB that contains a smaller subset, maybe just the user documents for offline scenarios that you could then synchronize back up to a main RavenDB store.
So the interesting answer is we had it for the last 2.5 years. It's called RavenLite, and I think that in that time we had two people make any sort of halfway interested noise on that. So we actually had an implementation that worked and was quite nice, including support for replicating back and forth. But there was just not enough people interested in that to actually make this a viable commercial product. What we have found is that most of the time when you're talking about, oh, I need to run on a disconnected scenario, in most cases it was actually easier to pull the things from RavenDB as JSON documents and just save them locally. Because you don't actually need much more than that. In disconnected scenarios, the amount of information that you're going to deal with is relatively small. And, you know, just so the thing that we're doing is we have the support for doing caching. So we actually haven't talked about the client features almost at all. But one of the things that we're doing is we're doing client-side caching in memory. And that means that by default, if you already have the item in the cache, the server can just reply with a 304 and that would be it. You can actually extend that to do the caching on the file system as well. And that means that when you're disconnected, you can get the value that you have from the client. You don't have to have the servers there at all, from the client, and still work with the data that you already touched. And that gives you the sort of behavior that you want without needing anything special.
So when you're working with local cache or in like a disconnected scenario, then how do you handle, you know, you change your local data and it needs to be updated to the server? Is it just a new, you know, how do you merge or update the document?
Yeah, that's a separate thing. And we don't have API for that. And we don't have API for that quite explicitly. Because think about this scenario where you actually have something like a disconnected application and I'm adding a note into a customer. So let's say that I'm a rep and I'm coming to your house to check that the cable is okay or something like that. And now I want to add that this person was very, very rude and we probably need to have someone talk to them or something like that. So I'm making this notation on my offline copy of the data. But I can't actually modify this data because at the same time that I'm doing that, someone at the head office is updating this customer record to say that this guy haven't paid in 3 months and his service should be disconnected. So now we have two competing updates to the same record, to the same document. And the question here is, okay, how are you going to resolve that? In this case, by the way, it's fairly easy to resolve because changing the status of a customer and adding a note about the customer are two distinct operations. But RavenDB has no way of knowing that this is the case. And because it has no way of knowing this is the case, there is no real algorithmic solution for the problem. So when we're working on something like that, what you're doing, instead of modifying the data, you're going to persist an event. So this is effectively doing event streaming, and when you're reconnected, you're going to publish all of those events to the server, which is then going to apply all of the modification on the server and probably tell you, okay, here is the new data that you want to look at.
All right. So we've had some other questions, one from Twitter from Jeremy Miller, and he asked, when is Iande going to fix Lucene.net's flow control by exceptions madness?
The answer is no, I'm not going to fix that. Yes, this is incredibly frustrating. Luckily, there is a feature. One of the reasons that I love Visual Studio 2012 is ignore this exception. And this is a wonderful, wonderful feature. And in general, Lucene is very, very fond of exceptions. Look ahead success exception, for example. And this is mostly because the parser that Lucene uses for a lot of the things is quite annoying for us in general. It just throws a lot of exception as part of its control work. We actually have a work item for writing our own parser. For different reasons, probably it won't throw so many exceptions, but this isn't something that I honestly really care about for that reason. You can ignore those exceptions, Jeremy, and you should. Yes, it's annoying, but you can live with that.
Okay. We had another question from Philip Autosnack, AUTOSNAK on Twitter, and he asked, why doesn't he do more for startups and small biz pricing-wise? Is RavenDB mostly meant for bigger corporations and setups?
No, we have offers for startups and for smaller businesses, absolutely. But I actually think it's mentioned on the licensing page.
Yeah.
You need to shoot us an email and we can talk about it.
Okay, so for people at a high level, how does it work for...
At a high level, you send us an email with who you are and what you're doing. And we can fit you with... So here's the deal. There are several RavenDB editions. There is the RavenDB basic edition, which costs $5 a month. And honestly, if you can't afford that, then probably just open source your application anyway, and then we'll give it to you for free.
Mm.
And sometimes you have, you know, startups or and non-for-profit. We donated quite a lot of licenses for non-profits all over the world. So I don't think that from a licensing perspective there is an issue. I think that, if I remember correctly, the standard license is $1,000, or if you go with a subscription, it's $400 per year. And if you compare that to any other database that you care to name, well, go to Oracle and ask them how much it costs, but be sure to have a medical team available for the inevitable attack. Yeah. A SQL Server is better, but not that better.
Hmm.
I mean,
Right.
So many.
I mean, you can really, really add up a pretty big bill on SQL Server. Yeah.
It's really quite funny because at some point I was looking at the feature metrics for SQL Server, and they have things only for the Enterprise Edition online index rebuilds. And I'm like, really? I give it up for any customer that we have. And replication support, those sort of things that, you know, those are the basic stuff, the very basics that you have in RavenDB.
Okay. We had one more question from Chris Wellums, and he asked, any thoughts on how to sell the idea of NoSQL or RavenDB to IT management and my boss that are addicted to SQL Server? So I know we covered a lot of this in detail at the beginning. Is there any kind of like quick, here's where you probably get this question a lot.
Mm-hmm. And here is the issue. A lot of the time, it's really, really scary to adopt a new technology, especially if you present it in a, okay, let's bet the farm on that, and if we misstep, I'm just going to do another consulting project for another company, and you won't see me again. So that's the wrong way of going about doing it. But usually what I found to be a very useful way of doing that is find the pain point. In most applications, you usually have one or two heavily hit pages that are really, really complex, require a lot of work, and really annoying to work with. Take those pages, move them to Raven, but don't go and say, oh, we've moved all of the customer information into Raven.
Right.
No, what we've done is we have created a persistent view cache for all of our customer data. And because this is so persistent view model cache, well, everyone knows that caching is good. No one worried about, oh, we have another cache in the middle. Because, and obviously you need it because the page is so. So we introduce a cache there. And because it's persistent, we can do a lot of other stuff that are really nice. And just then you have a foot in the door. So now you have RavenDB for the as a cache for the interesting pages. Yes, you still have to you have to write more code to do the migration back and forth. But we actually have, as I said, you can write to Raven, and Raven will write back to SQL for you. So that takes care of a lot of the work basically for free. And once you've done that, you can start using Raven for the trivial stuff. But think about that. How many times did you have to write user preferences? In what order do you want to see the tabs on the menus and those sort of things? And those are things that aren't, you know, from a business perspective, they don't really care about the customization they made for the application. But it takes a lot of time to write, and this is something that gets hit a lot of time. If you move those sort of things into Raven, well, this is just, you know, ancillary information no one cares about. Put it in Raven, you just, you know, persist the data, and it just works for you. So that reduces a lot of the efforts that is involved in actually getting things done. And over time, you can say, okay, this is, so now we have tried this and we see that it works. How about this new feature? How about we just do a spike on RavenDB for just to see how it works? And okay, we have done the spike. We've done it in 2 days. We can keep it on RavenDB, or we can spend the next 3 weeks redoing the same things on SQL Server, and it's going to be stolen harder and has more bugs. And this is, by the way, the approach that the guys at MSNBC took when they adopted RavenDB. They started by, you know, they just put a non-operating RavenDB server in production. Let's see how it behaves in production. So they put it, just put a node in production, and then they started, you know, okay, let's see what happens if we start putting this data on it. And it worked. And then they start moving more and more data, and now they have several major assets running on RavenDB. And I think that the way that they've done it was a really, really good way, because there was no point in which they had double or nothing approach, that they were betting the farm on something that they didn't know. They took it slow, they took it safe, and they got, I think, really, really great result out of this.
Okay. Yeah, that's a very comprehensive answer. That makes sense. So I think we're about out of time. Did we have anything else you wanted to cover in closing?
We have started doing bi-weekly webinars. So the idea is to give users direct access to the dev team and ask questions and see all the new features and see how we handle horribly failing demos. The last the last webinar that we did, the demo just wouldn't work, which was quite annoying. But, you know, I would really like it if, you know, if you're a Revenue user, or even if you're not, just hopping into one of those webinars, I think you will be impressed by what you see.
Okay. And do you have any upcoming, you know, speaking things or something you'd like people to know about?
Let's see. I'm going to be in London at the end of this month, and then I think in Sweden. We're going to have a Revenue BI course in the States around May, and those are the important things, I think, yeah.
Okay, great. Okay, well, thanks a lot. That's all the time we have this week on Herding Code, and catch us again soon.